Welcome to episode 4 of the Discovery Files. Today we're going to interview Mark Rue, who is the senior resource geologist at St. Ives at the time when the Invincible discovery was made.
Invincible, obviously, it's been a topic of the last couple of your episodes, and I listened intently to Aisha's episode. And she's one of my favorite human beings, not only because she genuinely is such a great human being, but you know, the way that she grew through that deposit is reflective of how I would say I grew from a different perspective. Because when we started looking at Invincible, it was just another target. You know, I remember she brought a line of drilling that they had just done and executed over the LT-17 target at the time. And, you know, we looked at it and I looked at it like anything else. At that time, if you remember, I was quite acutely connected to the exploration team. And I was, one of our passions was trying to build those early stage models, because as we were trying to use them as proper targeting deposits. Up to then, everything had been kind of like polygons and spreadsheet exercises. You remember that whole economic evaluation thing, which is, I mean, it had a basis of what we were trying to do, because at least we weren't just, you know, spraying and praying when it came to drilling. We were thinking about it in terms of economic context. But anyway, so we had looked at a fair few of those. And I think at the time that the focus was actually on Incredible, that little stockworky thing to the south. And there was a lot of hope for it because, you know, there was a lot of gold out there. It was, you know, fairly close to surface. And it was complicated because it was stockworky. And I think this was one of those sort of, I almost want to say an afterthought. Not, you know, yeah. We always knew about the target, but it was kind of an afterthought. You know, we were looking at something that wasn't in preferred host rock, you know, the black fat sediments. I mean, who would have given that a chance back then? Everything had to be, you know, the Piringa basalt or your dolerites out there. Those are your prime orogenic hosts out there. But when that first line came back, and I think you may have referred to it in that particular episode. I mean, there was a fair bit of excitement because those first few holes came back and we saw continuity. That was what I saw first. You know, you could drill a lot of stuff out there, and you know that, Scott. We had a lot of sniffs throughout that whole camp because it's, you know, it's laden with gold. But when you started to see continuity hold together on wider space drilling, we got pretty excited. And so obviously we accelerated that drill program. There was a lot of good effort from a whole bunch of people, right? I think you mentioned it in that episode. A lot of people coming together and recognizing that this could be motivated to something pretty spectacular fairly quickly. And that's why we were able to, I think 2012 was discovery. 2016 was probably reserve declaration. And I think, we were into production by 2017-18.
So, Mark, a question for you. So at this time, you were a resource geologist in the exploration team. Is that right?
Yeah. It was an interesting. I really liked the way that they had designed the setup back then, because exploration was kind of divided into, you had obviously your true greenfields, if you want to call it out there, but it was more like wide spaced advanced exploration drilling, and then you had sort of resource definition drilling that was explorations that were looking at extending current ore bodies and probably into true brownfields. I kind of like straddled whatever I could because I was we were pretty light anyway from the resource team. It's always difficult to get people, and we had a couple of, you know, resource geos that were pretty good at the short range modeling stuff, and they kind of went ahead and did that and looked after specific deposits. But I myself sort of jammed myself into exploration. My background is grassroots exploration. So I came from, you know, a diamond exploration background where we would, throw our arms around and think of things at a very conceptual stage and test things and do, you know, models with very little success. Because if you know anybody that's been involved in diamond exploration, it's a very refined taste, I would say. But rewarding when you do find something, which is very seldom. However, that was my basis, Ahmed. Like, I came from there, and that's why I kind of gravitated naturally there. The structure set up at St. Ives really allowed that for that. If, you know, if you wanted to go into something and take hold of it, and I was, you know, I was equally strong on the technical side as well, but always leaning into the geology. And for these early stage deposits, you really have to have a real good conceptual understanding of what you're trying to model from a geological perspective. And so that's why I liked it, and that's what we did.
One other question I had is, you mentioned that you wanted to include this more economic kind of evaluation in the work you were doing. Can you comment on, like, why did that come about? Like, was there like a conscious decision by the group to act a certain way?
You know, I think it was before I got there. There was an entire sort of process there where, instead of, you know, explorationists who can be extremely ambitious in some of their predictions of what they think a target is, 10 million ounces, we started to put a framework of what that might look like in terms of economic considerations. Because, you know, at a camp like Invincible, of course, there was thousands of targets. I remember we went through those target workshops, Scott, in that first year. We would have to sort of turn over those targets and really be pretty critical of what you had. And what we were trying to do there was saying, well, A, you know, does it fit into our, you know, strategic plan, like in terms of what do we need to fill the mill with in the next X 90 years? Are we looking for more open pit material? Are we looking for underground high grade material? And so we started to put that context around. And I think every mining company should do that. And most do, to be honest. I mean, strategic layers are in place for that reason. And they should naturally permeate into the exploration space. Because if you're not doing that, then there's a disjoint between the natural mining pipeline. Because that's what you're there for. I mean, it's cool to find stuff. But in a mining company, you've got to find stuff that you can make money off eventually. And that's what we try to frame.
Yeah, I think that was really helpful for the team. I know for me personally, it was really helpful because we could bounce ideas off of you. You were always available. And so I could walk over to your office and we could just talk about, hey, you know, we've got these holes coming back. What do you think? And it was kind of what you said earlier was one of the things was we had a lot of false hope, right? Where we would hit these pretty exciting intercepts. You know, you get like 6 meters, you know, whatever, grams. And it would look exciting. And then they would kind of fall over. And so I felt like working with you on that was a great way to essentially say, well, what do we need to see like next, you know, like for this project to advance? And I don't know, like I haven't worked at a lot of places that did anything like that. Just having where like I knew you well because I was in your office harassing you so much.
Well, I think you make a good point there, Scott, because I think there should be that natural communication. And you talk about discoveries and you talk about, you know, having the right scientific backgrounds and having the right scientific concepts, but it's equally and arguably more important to have the right people collaborating, because, you know, you've got a strong explorationist, you've got a resource geo. We're looking at things, obviously, the same thing from two slightly different directions. And we're looking at these two facets and we're saying, well, how do they join together? And making that story hold up together is important. You know, you see this in all successful deposits. It's about, you know, bringing that concept and collaborating, because and I guess it's always an interesting one. You talk about who claims, the discovery rights for these major ore bodies, and you know, Invincible. I think there would be about 10 or 15. You know, you look at things like Olympic Dam and the historic stuff that has been discovered. There's lots of people that were, you know, claim it, but you know, rightly so. There probably is a lot of people involved with different aspects of it. Yeah, there is the ultimate pioneer that designed that one hole that got in there, but you know, without the rest of after that, it is still just a good hit. And that's what's important. So collaboration and the right people at the right time is important. That is what Invincible was. It was a group of people that fought in the, you know, more or less the right direction. Look, we bumped heads, in particular when we were putting the models together, and we can probably lean into this a bit more, because this is where my growth occurred. It was about, you know, trying to understand how much conservatism you want to put into something and how that has actually resonated into laying the pathway for how I tackle any new deposit and anything that I that I model or have involvement right up to, you know, what I'm busy with today, which is 4 Mile. The same concepts that I've learned back in Invincible a decade and almost a half ago laid that foundation. So I think that's a key point that you bring up, that collaboration.
I mean, I think the interesting part for me really is the fact that, one of the things that I find interesting about the story is that you had that other deposit, Incredible, the one that didn't go anywhere. And the reason why I was kind of asking about the economic kind of review side is Because I think that's where that economic review kind of comes in, where if someone says, you know, like, yeah, we could be getting great hits here, but, you know, there's no continuity here. So it's not going to meet, you know, like the corporate goal of where we want to get to, right?
Yeah.
You know, whatever ounces or something like that. Because I think that is a trap that some exploration groups kind of get stuck in. You know, like it's hard to walk away from mineralization, right? No matter how patchy, how whatever it is. So you always need like something like a light switch to someone and go, hey, is it this? And you go, no, well, let's move on because, you know, like we can't waste any more time on this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and you know, Incredible is a good point. I think, Scott, you referred to sort of the false dreams. I mean, that continues to be one of those because it had just had enough out there that just kept drawing people back to it. And, you know, I had a good crack at trying to model it. Initially, you know, we had to try and discriminate the high grade veins out of it. So, you know, we're going non-linear on the estimation to try and do that. You did a fair job to pull that out. But, you know, it was just one of those that, you know, I'm not exactly sure what the status of it is now, given the current gold price that we're in at the moment. But it was one that was always just not quite there and drew a lot of people in. And the other thing I would mention is that a lot of explorations get onto these projects and they become, you know, very precious about making them want to work, right? And there's got to be a time where you got to tear yourself away and say this just isn't what it is. And I guess that's tricky.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of interesting how many places I've worked over the years that really drew exploration geologists into a target, you know, where you might have 10 or 20 or 30, or even when I think it was like 55 drill holes, and it still wasn't holding together, but it had enough gold that people kept going back to it to say, well, maybe if we drill it at this angle, maybe if we do oriented core, maybe. And it's like one of those like, you know, honey traps, right? Where it keeps bringing people back in and people get like incredibly emotionally invested in those. And I think that was one of the hardest lessons about St. Ives was there is a point where you have to walk away because you do not have the resources to do everything. And this is drawing resources away from you. And I think, you know, Incredible was partly that, but, it's just interesting to consider how common it is to see exploration geologists get drawn into those. And we're, you know, we're supposed to be scientists, right? But we get emotional about these things, right? And part of it is I think we have this innate desire to solve these puzzles, and we go, this puzzle can't be smarter than me. You know, I'm gonna figure this out. And so it's
also like the adage, right? Yeah, like one of the mantras in exploration is perseverance is key, right? So everyone has this feeling that they never want to walk away because, you know, like they don't want to be tainted with the brush that, you know, they never persevered enough. So I think that's where, I mean, in my personal experience, I think that's where the economic side is really helpful because you go, you know, like even if you could make this thing 10 times as big, it's still not a mine. So, you know, so should we spend more time on it or not? And I think that gives, like for me, I think it gives you comfort to go, well, you know, like we have collected all the data sets or all the ideas that we have, and it's still not big enough to meet our kind of economic, you know, goal, then I think that's okay for me to walk away. Because now if someone else comes in and collects new data or does something and, you know, they make a bigger discovery, good on them. But at the time, you know, like with the information I had, I made the best decision I could have.
That's a good point. I mean, that's, there's also the flip side to that, right? It's like, don't discount something that could be bigger than it actually is as well. Because there's often, you know, someone said they've looked at it or they've looked at this and it's just not going to fly or it's getting to the end of its life. And, you know, I mentioned and alluded to Hamlet at the beginning of this call because, you know, that was, you know, once we'd found Invincible and we'd got it going and it was like, you know, the flagship of new discoveries at St. Ives, we had obviously Hamlet, which was now, you know, a number of years old, and perception was it was small and getting to the end of its life. And we were drilling at the bottom of it, and it was good. I mean, like it was still going on. We started to do the economics, and it was getting a little bit close to that cutoff point. And so there was a collective decision that it's probably not worth investing any more capital into it. So Hamlet was interesting because we. you know, I turned my attention onto that, and this is another passion of mine. I really like to do a little bit of resuscitation on old ore bodies. And at the time, there was a perfect combination of people that came in. And Amulets at the time, we had incidentally Aisha's husband now, Sean Hood. He had actually moved across from exploration into production. He wanted to get some production experience, and he'd been placed out there for a moment, for a couple of years, and started to look at Hamlet. And we reviewed the geology, and he took some time to try and understand it. And we recognized there's probably some improvements to be made on the login, and there was inconsistency in the login, and that obviously the basis of your data input would have had an impact on the model down the line. So over the next couple of months, we got some loggers in, and we got some people that were like focused on what we were trying to do is just relook and just give this thing a good turnover. And so we were able to sort of improve the login, and that was then we were able to then get better domaining out of it. I used more localized directional controls on the estimation, so we were able to pick up some of these short range, high grade shoots that we weren't being picked up in the previous model because the domains were far too global, and in that they were sort of spread in. So we try to capture some of these to give the optimization a little bit more chance to improve, and that led to us being able to request additional funding for a fully fledged mine design program. So mine design was what we used to drill out just prior to grade control, and really defined where we put the basin. And it was just a lower Hamlet mine design. And again, credit to Malcolm Jolly and Don Krimvik at the time, because they were obviously the manager of MRM and of the geology side across the sites. And they approved what we were trying to do, and we were able to drill out that bottom part of Hamlet quite successfully. And we tracked it very carefully against what our geological considerations were. And this is something I do right now. So every single hole that we got, it's got to have a geological concept, and we've got to test it in terms of success, whether it's grade or are we finding the structure that we're trying to test, etc. So the long and the short is we're able to then not only improve the model down there, but enhance the life for 3-4 years and increase the strike length and the grade down there. But what was more important was, because of that, there was there was always this target sitting out in the northern portion of Hamlet that nobody had really closed off but had given up on because it was too deep away from the current mine. But because of this expansion of the strike length, we stuck a platform in there. And lo and behold, as it is with orogenic deposits, sometimes they surprise you, and this one certainly did. And that led to the discovery of the Hamlet North ore body. So a very high grade portion extension, if you will, but an ore body on its own to the north and extending upwards. And it was running at that time, plus 10 gram per ton ore, and which was 20-30% higher than the life of mine grade that we were getting at Hamlet. And so it was a great find, but it was a story about recognizing that there's still opportunity and sweating the geology, obviously getting the right people involved and just creating something that would allow us to expand. And I think it's a lesson that we should always look at when we look at legacy or aging ore bodies.
So you're saying you experienced a lot of personal growth during this time. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit? Because that sounds like the perfect lead.
Yeah, I guess Invincible taught me to realize what things could be, and I was inherently more conservative. I had about 10 years' experience, probably half of that in resource at the time. And so, when you're in your early part of your career, you're probably more conservative, particularly if you care enough about the ore body and think, well, you don't want to be burned too much. I'd come out of working for Anglo Gold in West Africa at the time, and on the Sigiri ore bodies there, those are all deeply weathered, very difficult to geologically control. So everything's done at that time, and probably is still now, anything in oxide is done through controlled grade shells, and we try to be as conservative as we can in terms of spreading grade where we didn't want to. So there was that sort of mindset of like, let's not get ahead of ourselves. And I don't want to do that with Invincible as well. And so when we did the first estimate, I was much more conservative in terms of how I would expand and how I would estimate and particularly classify. And I remember myself and Julian having a proper heavy conversation about, he was obviously a bit more bullish and wanted to push the estimation. I said, we just got to be careful because we've got to convert this stuff at some point. At that point, it was like a strong inferred ore body, and I was thinking ahead. But he was right. He was right in some ways, because you when you've got a concept that you geologically believe in, and it is starting to hold up, even at an inferred spacing, you don't want to penalize that too much, because you've got to give it a chance to go. And so I've learned to manage that a bit more and be a bit more bullish in terms of how I would approach all of my ore bodies that I've dealt with. And I did this now when I moved from there. Obviously Hammett was one where we thought we could get more out of, and then we grew into other ore bodies, and I had the chance to work in the initial phases of Gruyere as well. And we were estimating that, and that was just another incredible ore body itself. And working with that group of people as well, so just completely focused on making something incredible out of something that was not there before. But it required me to again shift from a more conservative approach to allow the ore body to stretch its legs, so to speak.
So Mark, when you initially had Invincible, was there any pressure on you, considering like Incredible might not have worked out? Was there any pressure on you to kind of show it was different, or to kill it quickly? Do you remember any of that pressure at all?
That's a good point. I mean, Invincible is never really Incredible wasn't really dying. It was just humming in the background. Nobody was actually walking away. But we, there was always this focus of saying, is it another Incredible? Are we, how much are we going to have to sweat something like this? Is it something as big as it could be? And maybe there was that sort of concept, is like, let's not get ahead of ourselves. But there wasn't actually a heap of pressure. I think, the team allowed us to work at the cadence that we believed this ore body could work at. We weren't ever slowed down. And certainly, I don't think there was ever a case where we weren't able to get the additional drilling that we were looking for approved to accelerate the project. And obviously, there's always the back of your mind that you want this thing to work. And there's always the risk that there's going to be, unexpected results on the negative side, which is not unsurprising sometimes. But there wasn't a massive amount of pressure, but there's pressure on yourself, Ahmed, to make sure that these things were considered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I thought that was actually a good I was thinking about Aisha talked a lot about the whole St. Ives School of Mines idea as well. But I know we'd had like Jackie Coombs been doing these resource estimation classes for the Project Gen team and other exploration geos. And even if they're not doing their own estimations, I think what I was seeing is it enabled the conversations to be much more, appropriate for the topic at hand, and what in terms of what we need to do, what we're trying to solve. And what would you say your interactions with the exploration team were like during that time? Like, did Jackie's course kind of lead to better conversations, or did you?
I mean, Jackie's course is good, wasn't it? At the time, we were trying to provide an experience where people can see a different result from what they're actually doing. So what she was tracking was taking explorationists and production geos on a journey down a resource model, and effectively, eventually, when you're producing a model, it's going to go through this sort of gauntlet, so to speak. And I guess it opened their eyes. I mean, Jackie was, and she's an incredible teacher, and she's patient to no end. I mean, I have a lot of time for her on that. But with a lot of these type of courses and experiences, it's very much up to the individual, to get as much out of it. And I think some of these guys really took it by the bull by the horns and became great resource geos today. I think of people like David Douch at the time, who was working through Cave Rocks, and Paul Edmonds as well. These guys were really, really good, and Aisha herself, and she came through that program, and so did I think Sean was involved with it, and we had a couple of the production guys who went through, and there was sort of mixed results, because it depends what you put through it. But what St. Ives was trying to produce was the holistic end-to-end experience of geology, whether it be an exploration rig geologist to a resource geologist. You could put your hand up and you could get that full experience. If you wanted to work underground or open pit, you would get that as well. And if you wanted to estimate anything that was a sort of short term and highly you know, highly drilled out or something that was a little bit more speculative, that opportunity existed as well. So yeah, I think it had its pluses, but depended on the individuals going through it at the time.
I mean, the thing that I guess the comment I was going to make is really, you know, like I guess I'm a little bit interested in at the same things that we kind of interested with Aisha as well. In that, you know, this was a team that I think, and you kind of mentioned this before, like, you know, it's kind of growing along with the deposit in some ways as well. You know, like you were not a finished product. Aisha was definitely not a finished product when she was going through this work. So can you talk a little bit about, I guess some of the challenges or some of the rewarding aspects of that? I mean, the obviously rewarding aspect is that, you know, you kind of build your career along the discovery kind of story or the development story of Invincible. But yeah, like what were some of the challenges you found in that space as well?
I mean, yeah, good point. I mean, like, I think one of the big challenges with working, you know, collaborating with people, there's always a reward, but there's always the other side of it, right? Where you're going to have alternate ideas, and you're going to be strong about what you think. And I use Julian as an example, because he was always very forthright in his understanding. And sometimes that was tricky to navigate when you, as a resource geologist, have to try and, you know, put some reality potentially into this. But you need to ensure that even through the areas that you potentially discussing items that you don't necessarily see eye to eye on in that moment, that you can see through that for what you're trying to do. And I think I've learned even now from that is that any interactions where I'm, you know, struggling to find a commonality on this direct linear path, if you try and work around it and realize for the greater impact that for the most part, we're all actually pointed in the right direction. We're trying to take slightly different paths through that. So I use that in everything that I do now, and it's far more successful than being hard-headed. So I've been less hard-headed about my direct path and realized that, you know, some alternative directions and conversations help. Because ultimately, you don't want to be too hard-headed and put a spanner in this, because you might be wrong. It's a hard thing to say, but look in the mirror sometimes. You're not always right.
Yeah. I mean, that's the part that I find really interesting. And I mentioned this on Aisha's thing is that, yeah, like you guys had found a deposit that was, yeah, like really off Broadway for stuff that was found in St. Ives before. And yeah, so on one hand, you have this deposit that, I don't want to say people didn't believe, but, you know, the belief that they have in what a deposit should look like in St. Ives was different to what you had found. And so on one hand, you have this, this kind of technical tension where you have to show that it is a deposit worthwhile, it's a target worthwhile chasing and et cetera. But on the other hand, you also have to do that same almost personally as well, right? Because you're all kind of sitting in new roles. It's a new team. You know, like Julian was very new in the role as well. I'm not sure if Malcolm was there for a while. I don't know the history, but Julian was new. Yeah, like Scott was new. I think you were like in your first year or your second year or something like that. Yeah, Aisha was pretty green. And so, so I feel like that, like, you know, like, I mean, obviously wasn't part of the team, but when I look back, you go, you know, there would have been quite a lot of tension in the space, not just corporately from a technical point of view, but also from a group dynamics point of view as well.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, you suffer from the natural imposter syndrome, right? Like, how good am I? Am I as good as I think? You put this thing out and it's like, it's, you know, shooting the lights out with ounces and grade relative to what you've done before. And you think, you gotta double guess yourself. You know, I do the same. I still do the same today. When I look at something like 4 Mile and we review and we look at that and we model it or any carbon deposit for that matter, you know, you got to sit back and have a self-reflection at some point. We were growing into that. We, you know, I think it shaped us in a lot of ways, not just technically, but definitely in terms of how we approach problems. From a personal perspective, I don't think I would have looked at any of the deposits and areas that I worked at after that if I hadn't had the experience of Invincible and St. Ives as a whole. So those 5 years that I spent out there were probably the most valuable time. And, you know, it wasn't easy, and it certainly wasn't a walk in the park in every aspect, but it was absolutely rewarding from a rounding perspective.
Yep. Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, it's I don't know. It's really interesting to think about all the different ways it could have gone differently. And like Steve Radford said a really good thing. You know, he said he grew up on a farm, and so he kind of like grew up, you know, he was joking around, like, you know, he was always wrong when he was young. So he learned how to learn from people. But I think that mentality persisted pretty well through most of the people at site, where I felt people were willing to listen to other ways of doing things. And they, you know, I don't know. So like, I think a lot of people were like, I know myself, I always struggled from the imposter syndrome as well. And so I think you can either like pretend that you know everything, or you can be open to listening and learning. And I think about just how different this might have gone if everybody wasn't so willing to learn.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point, Scott. And I think that's the best way of getting over anything that you might think of imposter syndrome, is recognizing that you are not right and you could be wrong. And that's fine as well, because we're allowed that, to give that scope. I'm like, you know, we could be wrong. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying this could be wrong, but let's give it a go. You know, we give it a chance to be what it possibly could be. We've got all these people sitting around saying, you know what, this could be something. You know, mm-hmm. we do the same with any ore body now. You should always look at that early stage and say, you know what, this is something that could be quite spectacular. Let's build onto it and let's give us a little chance, but let's allow ourselves to be wrong as well. Don't be so hard on ourselves. I mean, mm-hmm. the most successful exploration programs are the ones that probably fail a couple of times first, right? Because you build on that. And I think there's plenty of failures for every Invincible at St. Ives as well. And I could name them. I mean, Loot's probably an example, Incredible, Yacht Club, and we got a lot of these that we had initially got quite excited about.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's you know, I think Julian, because we haven't released his interview yet, but he discussed if Invincible hadn't been found, St. Ives might have a totally different story. It might have been like, all right, wrap it up, you know? And you think about my experience, because I've been through this at other companies, the sort of like desperation that begins to sit in on the exploration team when you're looking at the mine life off the edge of a cliff and you're trying to find something. And so I think about, you know, what a I don't know, like how much Invincible filled the lungs of St. Ives so that they could continue breathing while they did other things. And it just kind of makes me reflect on other projects I've been at where it's like, oh, you know, what if we had been more bullish on that in the earlier stage? You know, because like one of the things I've heard a lot is, oh, we need to find X amount of ounces. It has to be a deposit with X amount of ounces. And I keep looking at deposits all over the world where their footprint does not indicate that they would have X amount of ounces. And they just happen to have extremely high grade or really well-defined ore shoots or some other thing. And how easy it would be to walk away from that, you know, from a mine like Invincible, where you're like, oh, it's in the Black Flags. We just, you know, drilled Incredible, you know, Bellerophon's challenge as well. I don't know. So I just kind of, one of the things I want to get to the bottom of in this podcast is, how do we do things better? How do we check ourselves when we're heading down the wrong path? And so like some of it's going to be learning from successes, but a lot of it's learning from those failures too. Those really exciting failures.
Yeah. And you make, you know, I think to be able to talk just about successes is actually just a quarter of the story, right? It is what you learn, and it's how people reflect in those failures. I think, you know, allowing an environment where you can fail correctly, and I say that because there's a bad way of failing as well. You can do things wrong and you can get it like properly wrong. But allowing yourself to fail correctly is just as important as success. You know, you look at, and Julian makes a good point, without Invincible, I don't think St. Ives would be a singular entity. I think they would have, you know, it would have probably been divided up into whatever's left, a bit of remnant mining, and a few companies would be, you know, a couple of juniors and mid-tiers would have taken it over. But, you know, it led to the lungs of St. Ives were filled with the Invincible, because obviously after that we got the Alpha Island offset to Invincible South, which is another, you know, not as well spoken about, but, you know, the same system in a very high grade underground ore body that we drilled, and it was just as exciting. And it's it's got some unique mineralization features that we're still learning. That's the other thing about these ore bodies is that they, you know, spatially, they're quite variable. You know, the footwall veins, for instance, are quite different from the more continuous high grades, but they're just as important in terms of endowment. And even when we were developing that ore body, Scott, and when we were modeling it, I remember I was sitting with Stan Lee Zuto, who I think you remember him. So he was kind of looking after, and I was taking him through. This is probably when I was looking after the resources across St. Ives at the time. So towards the end of my move into the more regional role, and we, you know, he was like, "Well, we got to do something with these invisible vein, these extensional veins, because they were basically just captured in this." The volume and pretty badly estimated, but they were low quality and they weren't the mainstay. But now we've kind of like, and then as far as I know, there's been a lot more emphasis, and it's, you know, the amount of gold that's sitting in these extensional veins has allowed the team to look at mining in a different way and estimating in a different way. So I think that the other lesson to be learned is when you're in these ore bodies, and I guess I hop back to Hamlet as well, you know, don't think that things are going to be the same forever, and when things are different, don't be too hard on yourself that your first concept was wrong, and use some brave exploration while you're in these ore bodies to extend them. And so that's a good example of where I think there's even more life to it. And what that did then was draw people back into Invincible proper, where we started to, I think there was, you know, a view of let's see what those extensional vein potential are in the main ore body itself. And that's led to a whole different concept of how to extend the life there.
Yeah. And that brings up a whole nother challenge. Almost everywhere I've worked in orogenic systems is you have extensional veins, which are extremely difficult to model because they're usually very, very local. And so you can do like a very large model, or you can try to make little individual models, but then it's like one drill hole per extension vein and you don't have any
samples. Yeah.
And I obviously don't want to dive into the secret sauce because I don't want to get censored by anybody. But I think about just how important it is to figure out geological concepts like that with a team. So you go, okay, here's what we think it looks like physically. Here's how we can maybe drill it better, and here's how we can maybe estimate it better. And you know, you think about the people involved in that effort will have an advantage in trying to drill and model extensional veins for the rest of their career that almost nobody in the world has, right?
Yeah. Well, extensional veins are always going to be difficult because you're just not going to have the data resolution. But what you have to consider when it comes to extensional veins, or let's talk about stockwork type systems, is how you're going to mine it. You know, if these ore bodies, you know, you can't get selective on them because they're not going to hold up necessarily selectively. So you've got to think about these as more bulk deposits in terms of mining. So, you know, that should ricochet direct in terms of how you plan to estimate it. And if you're going to go into something more, you know, sort of, you know, large support based estimation, that's, you know, it's a completely different concept. And then perhaps you start thinking about simulation, which is where they went with the extensional veins, you know, trying to work out probabilistic approaches to these things. We may not be right, but at least you've got an idea of how wrong you could be. And that's probably how we approach it, and recognizing that you're not going to be correct on a local basis. And there's no point trying to, you know, spray this with drilling either, because A, it's not economic to be able to drill enough to be able to define it at the localized scale that you would normally mine these more continuous veins at. And B, I don't think there's any value in that anyway, because there's a better way to achieve it. And I think it talks to what you're saying, Ahmed, this whole idea of economic understanding of what it could be. You know, how are we gonna mine this thing, and it does it actually make sense? And these things need volume. So you wanna then start exploring for volume when it comes to extensional stuff or stockwork stuff.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I think it goes back to like, we talk a lot about risk tolerance, and that requires an acceptance of risk by upper management, right? Because.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You
know, yeah. Yeah. And that's the only way you can do that successfully. And so if you're risk averse, I don't think you'd be mining those extensional veins, right?
No, you know, not if you're holding yourself to be locally correct every day. You know, I've heard of stories of people that, you know, what are they like, tracking the MCF on a daily basis. I mean, it's tricky to live in that sort of world. You're not gonna put your neck out too far if that's what you're held against, right? So it does. It requires upper management to recognize, and it equally requires us as resource professionals to communicate that risk in those areas correctly. And that's where we probably let ourselves down. We're always hard on them. These guys, they don't understand what inferred resources. You want to mine an inferred resource? Well, that's what you get. The point is, they don't really know what that really means. You know, what does it mean to really mine an inferred resource? And what does it mean in the context of mining an inferred resource selectively or mining it more bulk? It's two different ideas. You can successfully mine an inferred resource if you're doing it on a bulk basis, because you're wearing that risk of a larger volume. That's fine. So we got to recognize that communication and put that out correctly to those that need to make those decisions on our behalf or wear those decisions on our behalf.
You know, since we're focusing more on the human side of discovery, communication is key, right? And it's something that maybe we're good at communicating to other geologists, but are we good at communicating to mining engineers or even upper management? And so I guess, what are some of the communication strategies that you've found that worked well?
Well, yeah, I think particularly when it comes to communicating, ensure that you've got all the stakeholders that are going to partake in your offering of a resource deposit, and that they understand from their perspective what risks are incorporated within that. So if you are talking to mining engineers, you know, probably not a good idea to throw up 1,000 variograms, but talk about really about what the ore body is going to look like from an extraction point of view, where you're seeing big bulk differences, help them walk them down that path. You know, giving that communication of what it means to mine certain areas of the ore body that are more risky than other areas, but, you know, make them understand that, you know, this risk is something you could wear because there's other areas that you could, that you've got more confidence in. So it gives them a feeling of, and understanding through that. I've always been, you know, I think St. Ives is an area where we had to be close to engineers for that reason. We were consistently, you know, we'd release a model and then we would, you know, we wouldn't actually finally release the model until we had collaborated with them in terms of the stope optimizations or the open pit optimizations. Then we would review together as a team what that looked like. So it wasn't just me handing off a transaction, a model, and then sitting back and saying, job done. We'd work together to put the story context in from a estimation and mining perspective. And I worked very well with Fiona Phillips at the time, and did so for a few years after. She was the technical services manager, and I think she still is one of the mining managers at Goldfields. And we worked together at St. Ives, and we developed this sort of collaborative understanding of making sure that we communicate the context of each model delta against the mining considerations and how that impacts A, the budget, how that impacts A, B, the life of mine. And we were trying to turn that over, and then that we're trying to simply put that together and bring that to management that they could actually understand it. So instead of us just giving a frightening story of a cut-off comparison, we would put context to everything. And that's important. That's the success of communication. You know, if you don't get that right, it's hard. It really is, because you continually having to fight amongst yourselves and amongst the teams to get that message correct.
This point of view. So Mark, you know, like obviously you're not on the same organizational level you were when Invincible was around. You now sit at a much higher corporate level, organizational level. What is some advice you would kind of give your younger self now that you've kind of seen the both sides? You know, you've seen kind of the worker level as well as the management level. You know, like what are some of the lessons that you could kind of impart on a younger version of yourself?
I think, you know, be braver in your decision making. I think, you know, back yourself a bit more. I think that's probably, you know, every young geologist, and particularly myself, was pretty hard in terms of, you know, what my expectations were. I've always held myself to a fairly high level, and you know, been particularly hard when it hasn't gone exactly as I'd mapped it out. So my advice would be, you know, don't be so hard on yourself. It sounds very cliche, but it is equally important. We know as resource geos, and it can be a real tough place sometimes when you're working through those models that aren't quite working, and you care a lot, and you'll spend many nights waking up in the middle of the night thinking about what you've potentially done wrong, and thinking that the world's kind of falling in and you've got this particular thing completely incorrectly considered, and you think the entire deposit's going to fall out because of that. It never does, and particularly if you care that much, there's often a lot of good work that goes into it. So what I'd say to any young geologist is, if I was myself, is, make sure you're not too hard on yourself. Lean even more heavily into the geology. Don't rely on the stats as much as you need to, but use the stats as a powerful tool. So it should always be I've always leaned that way naturally, but I'd even do it even more. So, I think geology, it's again, a fair cliche. Geology is important. Read papers, understand ore bodies, and carry on and do that, and never stop doing that. And there should always be a yearning for understanding ore body knowledge, because that is going to be critical when you're trying to recognize what an ore body should or could be, and where material mistakes would come in. Those would be what I would advise myself on that, Ahmed.
That's pretty good advice. I mean, I think one of the points you make, which I quite like, is be brave and kind of don't be too hard on yourself. Because I think one of the things you end up realizing in hindsight is that, often, any project or program kind of takes a lot of people and things to come together. And a lot of them are kind of out of your control. So you control the controllables, but you realize that a lot of the other stuff, no matter how hard you try, you may just not be able to kind of impart any change on it, right? And in that moment, I think you find an incredible amount of frustration, but I think later on you kind of realize and go, actually, that was not something I could do anything about.
I think the other thing I would also say is, when you're looking for someone to advise you, call it a mentor, technical mentor, pick carefully. And it's not always easy, but someone that you can look at and you can see a part of yourself that you would like to be one day, lean into that. Don't just take a person that's an obvious mentor. Take someone that you see something of yourself, a reflection. In my case, it was, I was fortunate enough to work and a couple of companies, actually. I was in consulting and with Gold Fields and with Sean Hackett. And I think, I don't know if you remember Sean Hackett, Scott. I don't know if you guys have come across him. But for me, he was one of these practical resource geos that taught me a lot of life lessons when it came to understanding resource geology. And it's like, definitely don't be too hard on yourself. Definitely give it a crack. And you're definitely going to be wrong. But that's also okay. And I think, I wear all of those things to this day, and anybody that I'm with, I allow that scope in. And you've got to have that, take that with you, because that'll lead you to more success than failure.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, what's the adage, right? Like, all resource models are wrong. It's just to what degree they're wrong. So, you just got to accept that you're going to be wrong at some point.
My favorite is, and it's kind of stuck with me in many ways, because it's the same lesson, right? It's get the geology as right as you can. But like, my favorite is, the only time an ore body is fully understood is after it's been mined out and backfilled, because then nobody else can go look at it and argue. We often talk about, we'll be within plus or minus 5%. And there's all these different people that say different numbers. I've heard as much as like plus or minus 1%. and I realistically go, if you got the geology perfect, but if you didn't, you talked about earlier, it's easy to lean on the stats, I think, because they seem to speak a very clear message.
Yeah.
But if your geology is wrong, the stats are wrong too.
And I think, I think one of the things we like sometimes underestimate is, even when it gets down to a resource, like resource drill out, volumetrically, you drill a very small portion of any ore body to try to then estimate to figure out what it could look like. It's unreasonable to expect that you're going to cover off all the variables, right? Like, you're trying to cover off major variables so the mine can start. And then there's a little bit of learn as you go kind of process as well that happens, right? The difficulty is that you know, like the processing side is built on your early estimates. So if the ore body changes too much, you're kind of stuffed because you've already built like, you know, a certain processing stream, you know, the flow sheet and all that type of stuff. But I think it's always a hard thing to remind people, because everyone kind of gets like, you know, stuck in this loop that, you know, like even at the stage of resource drill outs, you know, you're still volumetrically understanding a very small part of the ore body. Yeah. And that's where, you know, like, I think to your comment, Mark, like about being brave about making calls, I think comes in, because otherwise you'd just be mired in uncertainty forever.
Yeah, and I think that's a mantra you've got to take with you, and you've got to be brave. You've got to recognize that you're not going to get it all right. You know, there's something called the information effect. It's a statistical term, but it really is a geological term, right? And you don't know what you don't know until you know it, right? And you draw that thing out, it can be, you know, it can give you an upswing or a downswing. What you've got to know at the point of time that you're putting that estimation or that interpretation together, that you've considered everything and you lean into it. Like you say, I'm going to put my consideration to this that it is correct for now, but you also got to say at the back of your mind, you're never going to get it right first time.
That's why
you've got to be open to the fact that it's going to change, and some of that's not always going to be a pleasant story. You just got to make sure that you cover up enough of that risk at the time that you do it, that it's not going to be material to your decision making.
Yeah, so I guess one other question I had for you is what. And we've talked about a few things. So is there anything else that we haven't talked about that you would say has guided your career that you learned from this experience?
I mean, I think the fact that I've been prepared to build on the foundations that I've learned, whether it be how I approach people, how I, you know, sort of message upwards and downwards, it helped me really sustain a really good relationship when I moved to into the region of Roland and started looking after the Gruyere joint venture with the Gold Road Resources team, because you know you're now dealing with a separate personality of company that requires certainly different outcomes from the same thing, because you got effectively a junior at the time turning to become a first time mid tier producer. And you've got this major, and you know, we're the operating partner, so I'm the resource geologist helping or looking after it, working with, you know, sort of previous St. Ives people, like, you know, the likes of John Donaldson and Jane Levitt and all of these, this team that had worked in St. Ives and had that schooling. So, but also had a very different context of what they needed out of that ore body at the time. So I walked a journey through that as well, but it was important to build on the recognition of what we were achieving on a collaborative basis at St. Ives into these joint ventures to make them successful. And on all of those, I've built on, and that's gone through from back into doing consulting again, which was as important. But it's all about recognizing what the other person needs and navigating their requirements from something that not necessarily is the path that you would take every single time. So I've learned to become less bullish in my direction of decision-making. And I think that's built squarely on what I learned at St. Ives, and also just natural maturity, I suppose. But that is, that's been key in terms of what I've built. And I'd say that's would be a level of reason why there's been a fair bit of success in what I've been able to achieve up to this point.
That concludes episode 4 of the Discovery Files. Hopefully you enjoyed and you're enjoying the show so far. If you do, please give us a follow, and that way you'll get auto-notified when a new episode comes out.
Digging deep where the stories hide, through the hills and the mountains wide, pickaxe swing and the earth unfolds, chasing dreams in the dirt and gold. Geology calling under our feet, secrets are buried in the rock and heat. With a heart full of wonder and a map in hand, exploring the treasures of this great land.